So what we're going to do today is finish off this last little bit about EPR and Bell. That'll maybe take 10 or 15 minutes. Then we're going to spend the remainder of the lecture looking at properties of infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces and how some of the operational framework for quantum mechanics has to be just slightly adjusted, or we have to be a bit more careful in that situation. Okay, but first, to finish off EPR and Bell. So just a reminder what we did yesterday, and hopefully you've had a chance to think carefully through what exactly is being done in the Bell test. It's subtle. It takes quite a bit of thinking through again and again just to really convince yourself exactly what it's showing. It's worth the effort. You know, I think we can all agree that this is really a profound theorem about what the nature of the world is like. It's worth the time and investment to really to go through those details and figure out exactly what is being ruled out by a Bell inequality. Okay, so just a reminder of what we were doing. We proposed this Bell test, a singlet state, two particles go off to distant labs. There's parties in those distant labs which choose to measure their particle in one of three bases, A, B, or C, and they choose A, B, or C in each run of the experiment at random with their own free will. So there's an independence assumption in there. Sometimes, a third of the time, they pick the same direction, and we're going to enforce the statistics of the singlet state, which is that they get opposite outcomes in that case. Sometimes, of course, they pick different measurement settings, and there are some constraints on any local realistic model that might explain how correlated those cases are when they measure different settings, given that we demanded that when they measure with the same setting, they have to get opposite outcomes. So the idea here was to try to make a framework for all possible local hidden variable models that can explain the outcomes of these measurements without requiring any non-local degrees of freedom or non-local or communication between these two particles. And that put some constraints on the resulting statistics. So here's where we finished. We said that, well, you know, the most general thing you can write down, even without any dynamics, without any rules, without any way of thinking about how these different possibilities come out, we can enumerate just all the possible local instruction sets that these two particles can have. We can look at some general properties of those instruction sets, and we find that there is no way to have the probability of getting opposite outcomes be less than 5/9 if we're going to demand that when they randomly pick the same setting, they definitely will get opposite outcomes. There's just no logic or order or procedure you could devise that would ever lead to that being less than 5/9. And then, so that's the trickiest part in this. The easy part is showing that quantum mechanics predicts something that's less than 5/9. So let's just quickly show how that works. Reminder, we have this singlet state, which I can write out in the computational basis, but I can use any basis. Looks the same. So let's imagine we want to work out what's the probability for measuring two different measurement directions. What we're going to do is, rather than working out this calculation for all choices of A, B, C on one side and A, B, C on the other, we're just going to work out a general calculation for measuring some direction over here and some direction over here, and then apply it to the two cases. Because of the rotational invariance of the singlet, all we really have to work out is, let's imagine The first particle, particle one, is measured in the 0, 1 basis, the z direction. And let's, just to clarify my notation, this will be the plus 1 outcome, and this will be the minus 1 outcome. We're going to measure particle 2 in an arbitrary basis. So let's take it as the basis, how should I label this? Let's just call it plus n. For some direction n on the Bloch sphere, given by polar angles, theta on 2 plus, or sorry, 0, plus e to the I, phi, sine, theta on 2, 1. That's completely general pure state projector. Here's the orthogonal one. So we're doing a calculation that's working out the statistics for measuring the singlet in any two directions. But I'm using the rotational invariance property of the singlet to just choose the first direction to be the z direction, the 0, 1 basis. And then the other direction is anything relative to that. Okay? Then we're going to be able to specialize that to all the cases A, B, B, C, so on. So is that clear? Yeah? OK, good. Right. So then you can work out what is the probability of getting the outcome plus for both measurements. So that means particle 1 is measured and the 0 outcome occurs. Particle 2 is measured and the plus n outcome occurs. So we just have to use the Born rule. It's looking at an overlap between 0 for particle 1, plus n for particle 2, and this singlet state of two particles. And I'll save you the gory details. You can check. That's an easy calculation to do. You just get a half sine squared theta on 2. What's the probability that they both give the minus outcome? Meaning particle 1, we get the outcome corresponding to 1. Particle 2, we get the outcome corresponding to minus n. It is given also by a half sine squared theta on 2. And so the probability of getting the same outcome for both is just the sum of those two things. And the probability of getting opposite outcomes is equal to cosine squared theta on 2. OK, and it sort of matches up with your expectation. If I choose theta equals 0, meaning I'm measuring them both in the 0, 1 basis, then I always get opposite outcomes, which is what I expect for the singlet state. And then if I turn the direction of the one relative to the other, then I'm going to sometimes get the same, sometimes get opposite. And I can work out the statistics. OK, so let's just apply that general thing to all the different cases, A and A and B, C and A, and so on. So the probability of, we just worked this out, of getting the opposite outcome is this when we measure particle 1 along the z direction, particle 2 along some general n direction. So if the directions are the same, for example, if we have Alice pick direction A and Bob pick direction A, then theta equals 0, and you get that the probability of getting opposite outcomes is equal to 1. That's the known property of the singlet. If I measure in the same direction for both, I get opposite outcomes. Good. Quantum mechanics predicts the right answer. OK, if the directions are different, For example, we pick A and B. Let me just flip back to the figure a few slides back. I mean, we're measuring in one of these three directions. So maybe it's A and B, or maybe we're talking about C and A. No matter what different outcomes what different directions they pick, if they're different, then they're different by 120 degrees. We can use the rotational invariance of the singlet to turn whatever the choice of particle one is to the z direction, and what it is for particle two will be 120 degrees separated from that. And so we can work out all of the probabilities for different outcomes just as one calculation. This is 120 degrees. And that gives a probability of opposite outcomes is equal to cos squared 60. Here's one of those tricks between Hilbert space angle and Bloch sphere angle. You get a quarter. So already you're seeing how quantum mechanics is going to get through it. Let me write down the final step. If we do many experiments, then there'll be same directions about one third of the time. And we'll have different directions two thirds of the time. So let's just take the weighted average. The probability of getting opposite outcomes over our large ensemble of experiments run where in each run of the experiment, Alice is randomly choosing A, B, or C, Bob is randomly choosing A, B, or C. About one third of those experiments, they'll happen to choose the same direction. About two thirds of the experiment, they'll happen to choose opposite directions. And we can predict the total probability of getting opposite outcomes taken just over all runs of the experiment, that ensemble average. One third, one plus two thirds, one quarter, and that works out to be a half. And that is strictly less, of course, than 5/9. So how did quantum mechanics get around that constraint? Well, you can see it right here. We said in our local model, if we demand that when you measure in the same direction, they give opposite outcomes, there was no way you could set down a bunch of local rules that when you just happen to measure them in different directions, they give this opposite outcome with less than 5/9 of the time. Why? Because you just sort of go through all the possibilities. And if we're going to actually demand local variables that are saying, OK, if this one was A and this one's A, they have to give opposite outcomes, there has to be something pre-existing there that says, OK, well, then if instead I had measured this one in A and this one in B, this one has to give the, follow the same rules as before, and this one has to look in a different entry on its instruction set, and that probability is going to be bounded by below. That there are just, we've said that a million times, there's a bunch of constraints on just how small that probability can be if there were pre-existing local values to the outcomes of those measurements designed such that if they measured in the same direction, they must get opposite outcomes. Quantum mechanics doesn't have to do that. It doesn't have to pre-assign values to the outcomes of measurements that it has not yet performed. And we know this with non-commuting measurements, even on single qubits, two-level systems. And that allows quantum mechanics to have perfect anti-correlation when we measure in the same direction, but really, really low anti-correlation, only a quarter, when we measure in different directions. And quantum mechanics can do that because it doesn't have to have pre-existing values to all of those outcomes. Right. Any questions on that? You should be somewhat disturbed. Okay, let's just spend a few minutes talking about what that means. I mean, this, you can have a whole course on this subject. So we'll just sort of say it briefly, but what are the results that we take from this? What are the lessons? Well, so Bell proved that any realistic model that is local cannot reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics. So physicists often take this as a choice. You can, if you want to have a realistic model, you want to say there's a world out there with properties and I'm going out there and learning about them, then there has to be some non-local dependence of those properties. It can't be explained by a local model. And then other people say, well, let's just give up on the idea of a realistic world out there. Let's sort of get ourselves in a mindset of what Bohr was saying and don't even try to talk about the real physical situation. Only talk about the outcomes of measurements that we actually perform. So you give up on realism. I think it's sociologically fascinating that people are, physicists as a community seems more inclined to give up on realism than locality. It really goes to the heart of just how important locality is to our idea of a physical world, that we will give up on the notion of a physical world before we give up on the notion of locality in it. So you can also ask a question. I talked with some of you after the lecture about this yesterday. This is an experimentally testable prediction. You can say, is an experiment going to violate the bounds put on by a local hidden variable model? And this is now routinely done and has been done now for several decades. And some very recent experiments just in the last year or two have they're broadly viewed by the community as definitive ones that really close the book on any sort of loopholes or escape clauses to violating those inequalities. Yep.
Why does the physicist community prefer locality so much, favor it so much against, I mean, reality?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that. You know, why is it that when confronted with this apparent choice between locality and realism, physicists seem more inclined to sort of abandon realism? I think it has a lot to do with Bohr and the early arguments of quantum mechanics, where people say, oh yeah, I'm getting more comfortable with the idea of not assigning values to observables, and I can only talk about the outcomes of measurements I actually do. I think there's been 100 years of getting comfortable with this lack of realism that exists within Bohr's interpretation of quantum mechanics, whereas locality is just embedded, it's ingrained in us from the start. So I don't have a good explanation, but I think people are getting comfortable with that type of language and maybe not necessarily spending a lot of their time thinking through what are the consequences of really abandoning realism and going, to the full extent of the conclusions of that. What does that really mean? I mean, you talk to most physicists and they say, oh yeah, in quantum mechanics you can't do this and that. But of course they still talk about, I'm doing an experiment and there are electrons in there and I'm measuring them. And then, they're spinning around, they're doing things. They talk in a very realistic language. We all talk in a very realistic language. So there's a tension in there between the way people act and then what they'll tell you when confronted with this this result of a Bell test. Yeah?
But is the concept of locality well defined if you don't have any theory for quantum space-time?
So the question is, what is the way in which I can give up on locality if I were to choose to do so? And that's a very good question. So it comes to sort of my last point here, which is one that I really got to give credit to Rob Speckens as emphasizing to me. what he takes away from you know, the implications of the Bell test is that, well, okay, it's saying if you want a realist interpretation of the world, it has to be in some sense non-local. And you sort of say, well, okay, as soon as you have non-locality, all bets are off. I can have a lot of crazy theories. Most of those crazy theories will involve the ability to communicate faster than light with the other end of the universe and so on. The interesting thing about what we see, these correlations, these stronger than classical correlations in Bell tests, is that they cannot be used to signal faster than light. So although they're against the spirit of locality, and they're saying that if you want to explain things in terms of some hidden variables or some other dynamics of what's really going on, you need non-local equations. That isn't sort of realized in a way that we can use to communicate or to any other advantage. So that's actually, as Rob says, one of the remarkable things about the way quantum mechanics violates a Bell test. It says, okay, well, it has to be non-local, but only in a very protected, specific way that doesn't allow us to violate no signaling within a relativistic theory. So there's a tension in quantum mechanics. You can come up with all sorts of local theories that can explain, non-local theories that can explain the outcomes of a quantum mechanical Bell test. But if you look at the consequences of those theories, almost all of them would also let you communicate faster than light. So the fact that quantum mechanics has this tension between seeming to be non-local, it can violate the inequalities in a Bell test, but it can't be used to signal faster than light, can't be used to communicate faster than light. That tension is maybe something special about what is quantum mechanics compared to other non-local theories. So why is that? We don't have answers to that. Those are fascinating research questions, which I encourage you guys to solve, because they've been 100 years sitting around and nobody has very good ideas on ways forward for that. We could talk forever about Bell tests. I just wanted to use this lecture and this course to give you a bit of a flavor for that, and we're going to move on. But are there any last questions on that? If you're really bugged about something or bothered, then by all means come and ask me after the lectures. Okay. So let's move on to something much more mundane. Extending the framework that we've developed so far about quantum states, operations, measurements, which in everything we've done so far, I've restricted myself to finite dimensional quantum systems to make things a bit easier. If you extend to infinite dimensional Hilbert space, you have things like unbounded operators and wave functions that don't seem to properly sit in your Hilbert space but are nonetheless very useful, and you just have to be careful. Now this topic, I want to just cover it in the next 50 minutes. This topic is a bottomless pit. And again, you could offer an entire course on this subject. The first few things that you look at, it becomes increasingly mathematically inclined and physically not that relevant to most practical things that we work out. What I want to give here, but there are a bunch of things where you have to just be careful and you have to be aware of what can happen when you go to an infinite dimensional space and how some of the assumptions that we've made so far just require a bit of extra care. So I'm just trying to give you a taste for what is a huge subject, you could spend a whole course on this, it increasingly becomes within the domain of just mathematics rather than physics at some point, very, very close to where we're going to get to at the end of this lecture. Some references. I just sketched these down at the last second. I like this text on quantum mechanics by Ballantyne. Uh, Valentine. And in particular, that sort of influenced the way I'm going to present the whole idea of a rigged Hilbert space and the study of unbounded operators. So that's a good introduction to the subject, and it would be more than sufficient for most physicists. But if you want to get into more of the mathematical and technical details, a very more complete reference is generalized functions. By Gelfand and Valentin. Okay, so that has way more in it than I could tell you about in this lecture or could tell you about at all. Okay. So let's start with the idea of Hilbert spaces for infinite dimensional systems. So if we have a finite dimensional system, then the Hilbert space, the space of pure quantum states, is just equal to a complex vector space with a Hermitian inner product. But with an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, there are some subtleties. It's got a bit more structure than a vector space. So right away, I'm going to make a restriction to separable Hilbert spaces, which basically covers anything you'd be interested in just about anything in quantum mechanics. I'm not at all suggesting that some people haven't looked at non-separable Hilbert spaces for something very esoteric in theoretical physics, but to my knowledge, you don't need anything but separable Hilbert spaces to describe most things in quantum mechanics. Separable Hilbert space. And what do I mean by that? They have a countable orthonormal basis. So that could be infinite, but still nonetheless countable. So we might label it like this. And maybe the example to keep in your mind is let's think of a single particle in one dimension with position and momentum, and this countable orthonormal basis are the harmonic oscillator energy eigenstates. That's a nice standard example. Okay, so that's a orthonormal basis for H. Okay, so a Hilbert space is a bit more than a vector space. We can define complex vector spaces as using this basis as follows. Of all finite linear combinations of these basis vectors. So if I take those basis vectors and I start taking arbitrary superpositions of them, that's Vnn for Vn in C, such that Vn is equal to 0 for some any n greater than some cutoff, n max, sorry, I just mean greater than. So I can take finite sets of these basis states for any cardinality, and then I can form a vector space out of that finite set. That's just a normal vector space, and that will sit inside this Hilbert space. We can define a normal inner product, normal, the usual inner product on that. On V, that is sort of U and V is given by just the sum over those coefficients U star Vn. So that is itself a finite dimensional Hilbert subspace within the Hilbert space. So we have the notion of these increasingly large vector spaces with a Hermitian inner product. And then what we want to do to define the Hilbert space is to just think of it as the completion. So H is the completion of V with respect to the norm given by that inner product we defined. So it contains now things like psi, which is a sum from n equals 0. Now, that's up to infinity. That wasn't in any one of our vector spaces. But it can be in a Hilbert space. If at least those coefficients lead to a bounded norm. So an example, we can define states Vm to be a sum from from n equals 1 to m of 1 on n factorial n. This is for n equals 1, 2, 3. For any integer m, we can define that state. And then so each Vm is in V. But the limit, as n goes to the infinity, is outside of V, but in H. Yep?
By completion, do you mean closure of V?
Yes. Well, I mean, in the sense of, completing it such that I can, this is defining a sequence, and then of increasingly larger size, and I just want to close under that sequence. Okay, so that's a bit of just a formal definition of what is a Hilbert space. How does it relate to a finite dimensional complex vector space? It's sort of the natural extension of that. Okay, so let's now start looking at some of the more practical tools we have for dealing with these types of things. I'm going to introduce the notion of a dense subspace in this Hilbert space, because this will be very useful in making sure that all of the types of wave functions and so on that are eigenstates, maybe of unbounded operators, we can deal with properly. Okay, so let's define, let's say that a subspace U in the Hilbert space is dense if its completion is H. So here's, this isn't really an example. So here's a bit of an aside. What I want to do now, we want to now start thinking about some examples of Hilbert spaces and some of the practical problems of dealing with unbounded operators and how to define them. What I want to do is start considering that Hilbert space to be square interval functions. L2 of R. As an example, if we do that, here's just a little bit of terminology, which will be obvious if you think about it. The Hilbert space is not quite the space of square interval functions. If we consider sets of functions f of x, which just have non-zero values on some finite number of points, for some points k, 1, 2, 3, there's zero otherwise. So they're, let me say this explicitly, these are non-zero values only on finite set of points. This is, they're square integral, but they have vanishing norm. And so really, the Hilbert space L2 of R is, so they have vanishing norm, so they are equivalent in L2 of R to the zero function. So I could add any such function like this to the zero function, and it's still basically the zero function. I could add a function like this to any other function in my Hilbert space, and it's still basically the same element of that Hilbert space. So really, L2 of R is an equivalence class of functions up to addition. The equivalence relationship is addition of functions with zero norm. So having that in mind, we have these space of square interval functions, which is really an equivalence class. You can add on all of these functions with zero norm. So there's no requirement there on continuity or differentiability. The types of things that we use all the time in calculating things in quantum mechanics. So it's often useful to think about smooth functions in this space, the ones that are differentiable. They form a dense subspace V in L2 of R. There's our first example of a dense subspace. So this Hilbert space is an equivalence of class of functions with all sorts of non-smooth things in it. But there's a sense in which we can restrict our attention to smooth functions for a lot of cases. Why is that? Well, the space of smooth functions is not the entire Hilbert space, but it is dense within it. If we look at completion of that dense set, we get all such functions. OK, so then So let's see how this, there's some usefulness in thinking about this restriction to a dense subspace. Why is it useful? Because, well, there are a bunch of useful functions in our study of quantum theory that are not in the Hilbert space. So we have functions, or in this case, a distribution like the delta function, that's not in the Hilbert space. It's not squarenable. We have things like the momentum eigenstate, plane wave solution, it's also not square integrable, not in our Hilbert space. But these things, because they are the position eigenstates and momentum eigenstate, they're very useful. And when you first come across these in an undergraduate physics course, your lecturer probably just said, well, don't worry about it. You can sort of treat them like they're in your Hilbert space. So what we're going to try to do here is figure out exactly what space do they live in, and how can we act with them formally. Yeah?
You say that they are position momentum eigenstates. What does that mean if they're not in the right space? Your position and momentum operators work on the Hilbert space.
Yeah, so I'm probably being a bit sloppy in language here, but we have for position and momentum operators, they're unbounded operators. That means that if I, you know, write down formal eigenvalue relations for them, I can have solutions that are not in the Hilbert space. So we'll come to that at the very end. But maybe it's safest to say at this point is that in looking at the spectral properties of unbounded operators, you have to be a bit careful about what are the eigenstates in the Hilbert space and then things that are actually given by extending the domain of that operator and thinking about effective eigenstates on a larger space. So we'll come back to that at the very end. If you don't like it at the moment, you just ignore that I called them position eigenstates, momentum eigenstates. Just think of that as a label for what these two things are. We've seen them in quantum mechanics. Right now, we want to do a bit more of a formal treatment of what exactly are these functions or distributions, in what space do they live, and how can we use them in a mathematically rigorous context. So the first thing to be clear about is these functions. And so again, I'll say, just be careful, actually distributions are not in L2 of R. So what are they? Okay, let's just again do a little aside, a reminder. For a Hilbert space, H, finite or infinite, with vectors given by Ketz, there is a dual space of linear functionals . So I can think of bras as, what are bras? They are linear functionals on the Hilbert space. They take elements of the Hilbert space and map it to a complex number. So we denote this dual space of which these bra vectors are elements by H star. This is the dual space of linear functionals on H. And for a Hilbert space, its dual space is isomorphic to the Hilbert space. So that, what does that mean? For every vector in the Hilbert space, there is a functional, linear functional, in the dual space such that that functional acting on any other vector in the Hilbert space is just defined by the inner product of the original vector psi with the vector phi. That's the inner product in the Hilbert space between psi and phi. And we can think of that linear functional as defined by how the linear functional corresponding to psi, the vector psi, is being defined by that inner product. So in quantum mechanics, we don't even make a distinction. We say this is the inner product, but it's actually, it's not an inner product. It's just defined using the inner product. This is actually saying how a linear functional maps, which is an H star, acts on a vector. And the fact that those two spaces are identical means that we can really define that in terms of the inner product on the original Hilbert space. So the notation is all built around just even having to avoid that clarification because the dual of a Hilbert space is isomorphic to a Hilbert space.
Yeah? Is it has to be something like Reese's representation or something like that? But I think that there's something for self-adjoint operators called Reese's.
Reese's theorem. So when it comes to defining things like self-adjoint operators and so on, we'll come to that. I wasn't going to cover Reese's theorem, but you don't need that here because we haven't talked about operators yet. We're just talking about the space. You have a Hilbert space. You have a completely isomorphic dual space. And you can think of that really as the space of Ketz and the space of bras. And there is a relationship that takes every bra to a ket, every ket to a bra, and it is just going to be useful now to start reminding ourselves when we look at these weird functions up here that that there's a distinction between a bra vector, which is a linear functional on the Hilbert space, and the ket, which is actually an element of the Hilbert space. That little distinction, when we mix it together with dense subspaces, is going to let us make sense of these oddity distributions up at the top. Okay, so sorry, and I got distracted, so I didn't write the last part, which makes this make sense. This is for all phi in the Hilbert space. Okay. Okay. So keep that in mind. Think of bra vectors now as linear functionals on the Hilbert space. And for a Hilbert space, its dual space is equivalent. But if now we think of a dense subspace of the Hilbert space, the space of its dual space, the space of linear functions on that dense subspace actually now is different. It gets a bit larger. The more we constrain our Hilbert space and restrict the elements in it to a dense subspace, the more we can extend the dual space to include more elements. That's going to be the whole idea of this rigged Hilbert space that we're going to use to introduce a really mathematically rigorous and sensible way to deal with these additional distributions. Okay, so let me just say that explicitly. However, the dual V star of a subspace V in the Hilbert space is larger than H. So we consider a subspace of the Hilbert space, the dual space grows.
Larger than V?
Certainly larger than V, but larger even than H. There will be elements in this dual space that don't correspond to elements in the dual of the Hilbert space.
All right.
Yep.
So larger, you mean that the H star is a subset of V star?
H star, yeah, is contained in V star, exactly. A strict subset. Okay, here, let me just show you that what we've seen is a good example. Let's define a bra that is meant to be this position eigenstate, this Dirac delta function distribution. This is a linear functional that will act on states according to an integral over real space given by the Dirac delta function. And what do I mean by this? I just mean that. So here I've defined a dual that acts on vectors. Now, what vectors, what space of vectors does it act on? In order for that to be well defined, I can't act on any vector in my Hilbert space of square interval functions. I have to restrict to the dense subspace, or maybe I can restrict to a dense subspace of smooth functions, in which case this linear functional, this thing that acts on smooth functions, is well defined. Yep.
Maybe you mean larger than H star?
So formally, H star and H are isomorphic, so I treat them basically as the same thing. But you're right, technically. Yeah. So this is a well-defined functional. So it's in V star on the dense in H subspace of smooth functions. V, which is in L2 of R. So we defined smooth functions before. It's not the Hilbert space of square interval functions, but it is a dense subspace. And now it's perfectly valid to define a linear functional on that restricted space of smooth functions that really is, in a sense, how the Dirac delta function as a bra vector would act on those functions viewed as a ket.
And we have a correspondent B, associated with that bra in B. We have a ket associated with this.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so yeah, no, good point. So we don't have an isomorphism between V star and V.
Okay.
That bra vector, which is a well-defined linear functional on the dense subspace of smooth functions, does not have a corresponding ket in the Hilbert space, or it's certainly not in V.
That's why we have position eigenstates.
Yeah. So this is, I have to be careful here that it's certainly maybe not the only way to do things, but this is a perfectly good and rigorous way to formally have these Dirac delta functions in quantum mechanics, is to say, they live in the dual space of the dense subspace of smooth functions of my L2 of R Hilbert space. And I can do similarly for this momentum eigenstate. I'm just going to define it this thing is in V star as well, not a square interval function but a perfectly well-defined linear functional on the dense subspace of smooth functions in L2 of R. Okay, so here let me define now what I mean by a rigged Hilbert space. Rigged Hilbert space is actually a triple. V, H, and V star. So this is a dense subspace of H. And this is linear functionals on V, on that dense subspace. So in a sense, here's our Hilbert space. It contains all kets and equivalently all bras. There's a one-to-one correspondence between them. V here is a restriction of that. There are kets in here that don't live in here. And this is an extension of the dual space of H. There are bras in here that are not in the dual space of H. Yeah?
Don't you mean for the second one that, so your momentum operator is a functional on a different space V, but it is actually a different space V, so V prime.
Yes. So yeah. Okay. Good point. So I have to pick. Yeah. I have to pick a different. Let me make a note of that. Sorry. There exists a dense subspace V prime in L2 of R, which could be, for example, L1 of R. P prime is a linear functional on V prime star. Yeah, so that's, this is a good point. I don't mean to mean that there's always sort of a unique preferred dense subspace that you should use, and then you can have every linear functional defined in a Riggs Hilbert space made from that. Sometimes you have to be a bit adaptive and pick different dense subspaces of H for given linear functionals that you may want to include in your theory. Yeah?
So when we write the resolution of identity using Px, bra, Pxket,
Yeah. Okay, so good question. If I tried to write out the resolution of the identity, I mean, here I've made sense of the bra vector. I haven't and I don't want to define a ket vector for corresponding to the delta function. At the moment, I can't see how to make formal sense of that.
We don't think that's a composition of two.
Yeah.
Okay. Notation in some sort.
Yeah, I mean, so that's, I'm trying to put things on a rigorous footing, but certainly you will read in lots of things people just using notation and often a sloppy notation for, direct delta functions written as kets and so on. But you should be aware that you can put these things on a more rigorous footing if you want, but you do have to be careful then of here's a key warning is that when you restrict to a dense subspace, there is not necessarily then a one-to-one mapping between kets and bras, and there will exist bra vectors that do not have a corresponding ket. Okay, and so this whole formalism, I mean, the Dirac notation is built around the fact that H is equal to or equivalent to H star, and bras and kets can be turned into each other, and we don't have to make a distinction there. We can write that action of the linear functional, it's equivalent to the inner product. The whole Dirac notation is built around that equivalence, and here we've made a distinction. If you want to apply the Dirac notation to a rigged Hilbert space, you have to be much more careful. So it's just a word of warning. Okay, so in the last 15 minutes, we're just going to say then a bit about now unbounded operators. Okay, so this rigged Hilbert space is useful for understanding eigenstates of some unbounding operators. Okay, I haven't defined unbounded operators, so let me do that. Sorry, let me define what a bounded operator is, which makes more sense. So A on, it's an operator on H, is bounded if there exists some number such that the norm of A on psi, and this will be for any state psi, is bounded by n A times the norm of psi. Oh, sorry, not squared. For all psi in the domain of A. I can define operators that actually don't have to have support on a whole Hilbert space. They can just have some domain, and it still makes sense to ask if they're bounded. So they might only act on smooth functions. That's fine. Then I just can, you know, check this condition just for smooth functions. Okay. So loosely, we think that just means it's putting a bound on its largest eigenvalue, right? Yeah?
Well, what do you mean domain of A when you say A is on H?
Yeah, okay, I was sloppy, thank you. So on some subspace of H. Yeah, so A on H, but I guess I loosely think of it as it's an operator on a Hilbert space, but its domain might be actually restricted, which is an abuse of terminology, but that's a common one. Okay, so let's consider some examples of unbounded operators. The position operator, the momentum operator, Hamiltonians that take the form of p squared on 2m. We're all grown up, so I don't need to put hats on things, right? So I'll stop as of now. You can laugh at me if I do, by instinct. Are unbounded. You can sort of see that. I mean, there are, yeah. I mean, if you think loosely of what's the spectrum of the position operator, it has eigenvalues that are of arbitrary magnitude. Okay, so just yeah, as we said, the domain may only be a dense subspace of L2 of R. Let's specialize to this Hilbert space and talk about operators with position momentum. Yeah?
You call X an operator, like from what space to what space is, does X work?
Yeah, so okay, I was just about to do that, but yeah, so we have X as some operator. How does it act on L2 at R? Well, I'm not gonna actually pick L2 at R as its whole domain. I wanna restrict the domain of X, I mean, so, Here's the problem. Psi of x could be square integrable. But x psi of x, which is how we normally think of the position operator acting on some functions, may not be. So I might then want to restrict my attention in trying to even define what is that position operator to be acting on some subspace, preferably dense, for the whole Hilbert space. And you know, as another example, the momentum operator, which is in the position representation, taking the derivative with respect to x, it's not defined unless psi of x is differentiable. So I might say I'm going to restrict the domain of what I mean by the momentum operator to differentiable functions in L2 of R. Okay, here's a little good news, at least. I should have written it up here, because it's only good news for bounded operators. For bounded operators, basically, if they are well-defined on a dense subspace of the Hilbert space, then they have a unique extension to the entire Hilbert space. But that only holds true for bounded operators. So we here we could say, let's define the momentum operator as in terms of its action on the dense subspace of differentiable functions in L2 of R. But that does, because it's unbounded, that does not mean that it has a unique extension to the full Hilbert space. And in fact, for this operator, it does not. Only for bounded ones is there a unique extension. So for bounded operators, if they are defined on a dense subspace of H, they have a unique extension. Okay, so you know that, what we're getting short on time. Let me just say a bit more about bounded operators and the relationship between self-adjointness and hermeticity. You know, most of what we're going to be covering here, just in case we really start running out of time, is just putting on caveats on how to make sure that we're being a bit careful with really what is the space on which these operators act, and what can I say about them. Okay, so for bounded operators, there's far fewer caveats. If A is a bounded operator on H, and we have some element of H, vector in H, then the map from H to C defined by so psi is state, we map that to phi A psi is a bounded linear functional on H, meaning that that linear functional has bounded norm. And therefore, there exists a linear functional such that that linear functional is given by phi A on psi. So what are we doing here? We're saying if you have a bounded operator, I can take an element of the Hilbert space, I can define this linear functional, And this is going to let me define the adjoint of A. It's the operator A dagger, which takes phi to this newly defined linear functional eta. So i.e., so this is just a mechanism to use this nice dual structure of Hilbert space to say, if I've got an operator on the Hilbert space, I can define this new operator, the adjoint, which also acts on a Hilbert space. I'm sort of defining it by thinking about how it acts on that space of linear functionals. It wants to act on a space of linear functionals viewed as isomorphic to the Hilbert space in the same way that the original operated it on cats. Does that make sense? And if, since A is a bounded operator, we have then that A dagger is also bounded. And the norm of A dagger is actually equal to A. And then finally, we say that a bounded operator is Hermitian, or equivalently, self-adjoint. These are equivalent notions for bounded operators only if A dagger is equal to A. Okay, so as usual, if you restrict to bounded operators, the things that you've taken for granted in a finite dimensional Hilbert space sort of map across. And I can think of operators acting on cats, or equivalently, their Hermitian conjugate or adjoint acting on bras. The problem is, you know, a lot of our operators are not bounded operators. So what can we do, just in the last couple minutes, what can we do if we have talking about unbounded operators? Well, we can still define this notion of self-adjoint. We just have to be a bit more careful. And so A is a densely defined, meaning I've picked the domain of A to be a dense subspace of the Hilbert space, linear operator on H with domain D of A. That's the dense subspace. Might not be the whole Hilbert space. If it was the momentum operator, that might be the dense subspace of differentiable functions. Then we consider the set DB of all functions in the Hilbert, or sorry, vectors in the Hilbert space such that, again, we define a map. Psi goes to phi A psi, such that this is a, the map defined by this is a bounded linear functional on this domain of A. So just the distinction here between dA and dB, so dA is the dense subspace of the Hilbert space on which this operator is even well-defined. We can actually imagine a completely different set of bra vectors that sort of live on the other side of the operator. And you know, they don't necessarily have to be in dA. They can be in a different set. That nonetheless makes this linear function well-defined. So again, you should have in your head that the way we've defined it here, dB can be a bit bigger. We can include more things that are not bras corresponding to kets in the Hilbert space. There are more exotic things, but where nonetheless that linear functional is still going to be well-defined. So we get more from dB if we need it. Okay. So for some vector in this dB, we can define an operator . Here's how it acts on dA. This operator B is the adjoint of A. So B we can just write as A dagger. The important thing to remember here is that even its domain of action has changed. Okay? We had an operator A with a domain dA. Now we define its adjoint B, or A dagger, with a different domain, now associated with things we pulled across from this dense space of linear functionals. So a little bit of terminology. A is Hermitian if dA is contained within dB. I'll now write it as dA dagger. And A on vectors is equal to A dagger on that. It looks like it is self-adjoint when it acts on things in dA. And it's self-adjoint if dA is equal to dA dagger, if those spaces are identical. So then we can really say, so these operators are equivalent as operators. They have the same domain and that's not really a so, that's really an and. They have the same domain and they act the same way on that domain. Okay? So, we're out of time, but the key point here is that if you want to treat unbounded operators, you have to be careful about what their domain is. Also have to potentially make a distinction between whether they are, we normally work with Hermitian operators. You can have Hermitian operators that are not self-adjoint because of this sort of mismatch in the domains of the two. If they turn out to be equal, then we do have a self-adjoint operator. It's often, there are useful non-self-adjoint operators even in quantum mechanics. People try to describe a phase operator for a quantum harmonic oscillator, you end up writing down something that is not going to be self-adjoint, but nonetheless, you can end up using it quite usefully for calculations. You just have to be careful what you're doing on what it's acting on. Okay? It'll have a much more limited domain than the whole Hilbert space, so you can't just act with it on any arbitrary state. Okay, sorry for going a bit over time. If people have questions with that, come up and talk to me. Any quick questions? Okay, I'll stick around if you want to ask me something.